Jesus took Peter, John, and James and went up the mountain to pray. While he was praying, his face changed in appearance, and his clothes became dazzling white. And behold, two men were conversing with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his exodus that he was going to accomplish in Jerusalem. Peter and his companions had been overcome by sleep, but becoming fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. As they were about to part from him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." But he did not know what he was saying. While he was still speaking, a cloud came and cast a shadow over them, and they became frightened when they entered the cloud. Then from the cloud came a voice that said, "This is my chosen son, listen to him." After the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. They fell silent and did not at that time tell anyone what they had seen. The Gospel of the Lord. It's sometimes helpful because we read these Gospels, these passages from Scripture every week, every day at Mass, but we read a little selection from the Gospel. But the Gospel, of course, always, it's a story, and all these selections have a context. So I think that a little bit of exegesis might be helpful in drawing something out of this passage. So a couple of things I want to point out about how this particular story, this passage, the story of Jesus' transfiguration, how it relates to a couple of other things in the gospel. So first of all, in all three of the synoptic gospels, so Matthew, Mark, and Luke, this passage about the transfiguration is connected to Peter's proclamation of Jesus as the Messiah. So what happened immediately prior to this is Jesus was asking his disciples, and it's hard for us to remember sometimes that the disciples didn't, during the time of Jesus' life, they didn't necessarily really understand what was going on. They knew Jesus was something, and they were following him. That doesn't mean that they fully understood what it was that it was going on, or who it was that he was following, or what it all meant. So Jesus was asking them, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter was the first one to recognize who, the first one besides the demons, which is a whole other interesting thing to talk about. But he was the first one to recognize Jesus for who he was. "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And this was a moment of glory. This is a moment of glory because glory is when, in a sense, who Jesus really is manifests himself. Or when God manifests himself, that's a moment of glory. And Jesus recognizes that. So Peter is able to name him as Christ, the Son of the living God, not because somebody else told him or because he deduced it using human logic, but because it was revealed to him by his Father in heaven. But what happens once Peter recognizes who Jesus is and Jesus sees, "My Father showed this to you," he immediately begins to talk about his passion. And this is because he always wants to make it clear. Whenever in the Gospels we see Jesus in glory, it's always connected to the cross. When Jesus is spoken of as a Messiah, he immediately begins to speak of the suffering and death and betrayal that he must experience. So soon as Peter acknowledges Jesus, Jesus begins to talk about his death. Right? And that story is connected to what happens up here in the mountain where Peter, James, and John, that sort of like Jesus' favorites, that blessed three, they get to be with him for those really special moments. They witness Jesus' glory. They get a glimpse and a sense of the resurrection. And he's speaking to Moses and Elijah who appear in glory. But what are they speaking of? They're speaking of the exodus that he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. And we certainly can't read that exodus as being anything other than his passion, death, and resurrection, right? Of course, to call it an exodus is to refer to the Exodus event where Israel was led out of slavery in Egypt into the desert where they would receive the covenant and ultimately into the promised land. But the specific Exodus that Jesus is going to accomplish is he's going to lead us out of bondage to sin and death. So when we see God's glory, when we see who Jesus really is, when we see this glimpse of the glorified Lord, it's immediately connected for Peter, James, and John, and through them for us. It's connected to the work of Exodus that he's going to accomplish. But there's also a reminder of and an instruction on what kind of Messiah Jesus is and what kind of Exodus he came to accomplish. And this is actually, it's really important to remember what kind of Messiah Jesus is. Jesus knew it was important, which is why every time somebody recognized him as the Messiah, he speaks about the cross. And the reason it's important is because we want to turn Jesus into all sorts of things for us. We remember, for instance, that in the times, in the historical context that Jesus came into, there had been an expectation for a Messiah. But for many people, it was a Messiah of worldly power, a king or a military leader that was going to rise up and reestablish Israel's autonomy and, in a sense, manifest God's glory through Israel to the whole world. And so when a Jew would say, "You're the Messiah," there's a good chance he was thinking, "You have come to conquer our enemies," which is true, but only in a spiritual sense, right? What are some other things that we try to do to Jesus, which essentially are corruption of the gospel? Well, something that's popular in America, not so much in Catholic America, but you've heard of the prosperity gospel, right? It's people really love and get excited about believing that Jesus wants us to be materially blessed and that he wants to reward our faith with material blessings, right? Health and wealth and worldly happiness and all that sort of thing. I don't know where the prosperity gospel came from, but it definitely did not come from reading the actual gospels, right? Because the actual gospels make clear Jesus' destination is the cross, and if we want to be disciples, we have to follow him there. And by the way, we have to carry our own crosses there. And I think within the context of how, the Lord's power of revelation, the form of revelation, I don't think it's a mere historical coincidence that all of the apostles except one laid down their life for Jesus, that 11 of the 12 apostles died for their faith, right? It's a concrete living out of the fact that Jesus told his disciples, if you want to follow me, you have to take up your cross, right? The entering into the grave with me, that's what discipleship means. Another way we can distort the gospel is to kind of reduce the gospel to the gospel of social teaching. And that's something that has a little bit more backing it up in the scriptures, right? Jesus talks a lot about taking care of the poor, how we treat those who are the least among us. And in fact, he attaches salvation to how we treat the least of among us. But still, it's not sufficient. So if we look at the Gospels themselves, what sort of Messiah is Jesus? What sort of Exodus is he going to accomplish in our lives? So he's really not telling us that he's going to accomplish, if you follow me, you're going to have all sorts of prosperity and worldly happiness. Definitely does not promise that. He doesn't promise that if you follow me, I am going to, in this world, establish a just political order where there's no poverty and no suffering. He definitely doesn't say that. The Exodus that Jesus accomplishes is he sets us free. He leads us out of liberation to sin and death. This is the victory that Jesus wins. This is the kind of Messiah that he is. He sets us free from sin and death. But the only way to follow him into that victory is to follow him into the cross, to follow him into the grave, so that we can share in his resurrection. Now, that could be a frightening thing, and it could be something that maybe jars us and makes us not want to follow Jesus, because you're saying, not only, Jesus, you're not promising me prosperity if I follow you, but you're actually promising me suffering. You're promising me a share in your cross. You're telling me that I'll drink of the cup of which you're about to drink, which is your suffering and death. And that stumbling block, the church fathers would say, is exactly why Peter, James, and John had been brought up to the mountain to witness this event today. Right? The church fathers, one of the main interpretations of the transfiguration is that Peter, James, and John got to witness this sort of glimpse of the glorified Lord so that they would not be scandalized and would be able to persevere when Jesus underwent his actual passion. So that when all seemed to be lost, they would remember what they saw and they would realize that everything that Jesus was going through was worth it. Right? By the way, there's another kind of parallel passage to this gospel, which is the agony in the garden. And the agony in the garden is almost the reverse image. Right? The agony in the garden is another mountain in which he goes up on the Mount of Olives. Again, he takes Peter, James, and John. But here we don't see him transfigured in glory and talking to Moses and Elijah. Here we see him sweating blood and telling the Father, please let this cup pass by me. So we see him entering into the depths of his passion. And I think the hope is that Peter and James and John witnessing this will remember what happened last time they were up on a mountain praying with Jesus and be able to persevere and know that this is actually the way and that it's worth it. So what does this... Maybe these are all fine things for gospel interpretation, but what does this mean for my life? And I'm always a little bit sensitive to, am I preaching the gospel in such a way that it's going to seem unattractive to people? Am I telling you that if you're a good Christian, you have to go look for ways of suffering? And I might be wrong about this, but I've always thought that's not the case. If you stop and think about it, everybody suffers, period. Everybody suffers. There's no such thing as escaping suffering in this life. But how we suffer and what that suffering means, I think, can be radically different for the Christian. Suffering in and of itself is an evil and it's senseless. And if there were no Jesus, if there were no cross and resurrection, then we should flat out do what we can to avoid suffering. But Jesus, because he endured suffering, actually changes the meaning of suffering. So all of us have it. Nobody escapes the cross in this life. But if we don't embrace the cross, if we try to run from it, we don't really find happiness and lack of suffering. What we find is despair and frustration and emptiness, right? And the more we, for instance, the more kind of like analgesics we use to try to numb away suffering or make it so we don't have to think about it, don't have to feel it, this sort of abyss opens up inside of us. And that becomes, I think, an even greater and deeper suffering. Whereas those of us who are able to, in faith, embrace the crosses that Jesus gives us, or that God allows us to have, unite our suffering to his, it becomes something meaningful, it becomes something powerful, it becomes something not that oppresses us, but that actually sets us free. It allows us to enter more deeply into the meaning of Jesus. So we don't want to be afraid of suffering because we see that that's where he's actually leading us. We remember that the exodus that Jesus wants to accomplish in our life is freeing us from sin and death. And St. Thomas Aquinas says that our greatest share in the cross is simply that it's hard for us to be good because we're fallen and weak. All right, so if you imagine that carry your cross means like going out and finding a way to be persecuted for Jesus so that you can suffer as a disciple, St. Thomas says, look, because of our fallen nature, it's hard. It's painful for us to be good. And the more we try to grow in holiness, the more aware we become of how weak and impotent we are. And that's a cross. And we don't set that cross aside. We don't quit trying. We don't run from the cross. We embrace it. We embrace the suffering of allowing God to transform us into saints. And then that suffering becomes meaningful. And then that suffering becomes redemptive. And my one last thought is, we return to what the fathers say about this passage, that Peter, James, and John, and us through them, being allowed to witness this moment of transfiguration so we can be sustained in the face of the cross. If we as Christians come to believe that Jesus is setting us free from sin and death, and we're not looking for him to give us worldly well-being, if as Christians we are able to remember the good things that he has given us. If we're able to remember, in a sense, those moments when he pulls back the curtain and shows us his glory, when he gives us little glimpses that tell us that it's worth it and it's worth persevering. If as Christians we can do those things, then suffering is no longer something that's insurmountable to us. It's not something we get to be afraid of. Suffering is not an occasion for us to question God and to say, why have you abandoned me, Lord? We begin to recognize it as a deeper state of growing in discipleship and further abandoning our lives to him.